Thank you so much all for joining. This is Prashant Kumar, your host. My name is Prashant Kumar. I have a guest whom I'm going to introduce you in like a minute. But just a little bit about myself. Basically, folks, just my shameless introduction. It's not needed too much. I mean, most of you know who I am. I'm a multifamily syndicator with strong technology background, and I spend a lot of time analyzing deals. I've been involved in about 1200 units in GP capacity, own my own portfolio of 100 units, and I have been exploring assisted living for last 2 years, and we are trying to get into a ground up project for assisted living. The goal of my life is not just to do business, but to extend help to those who are getting into the business, and hopefully help others to so that they grow too. So, I plan to do syndications in multifamily and assisted living, but more than that, I'm here to help. And it just so happens that, we're going to share a little bit more today. So stick around till the end. Having said that, I'm going to introduce, I'm going to stop sharing. I'm going to introduce my great friend, Mike Morosky. I know Mike for almost, I would say maybe 6 months or a year. But ever since I talked to Mike, we had great connection. We talked a lot of times, actually. Not that he's a busy person. I mean, very busy person. We talked a lot of times. And we kind of connected very, very well. So Mike has been in real estate for 30 years, right, Mike? And yep. he has controlled over $285 million worth of real estate transactions. He's an entrepreneur, author, real estate trainer, public speaker, and personal coach with strong personal resilience and a deep desire to help others live an extraordinary life. He has coached hundreds of real estate investors to fulfill their dreams. He's an author of Exit Plan. He's a founder, CEO of Micro Intentions. He's the host of Insider Secrets podcast. He's a real estate trainer, personal coach. And his introduction can go on and on. There's no topic in real estate which he cannot talk about. Today, we are going to focus on the importance of an exit plan. Having said that, Mike, very, very welcome to our webinar today. I don't have any words to say. How much I know you and how much have I learned from you. So, Mike, once again, thank you so much for joining.
Prashant, thanks for having me on. And thanks for the warm welcome. I appreciate that very much. And glad to be here this evening.
Very good, Mike. I would like to ask Mike your pet peeves. What is that brought you to real estate? I mean, tell us a little bit about your background and tell us why real estate and what is the best things that you have learned in real estate?
Yeah, absolutely. And, I love your question, why real estate, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder, I don't know. I grew up in a family that wasn't entrepreneurial, didn't do real estate, weren't in business for themselves. But, one of the lessons I learned growing up was my dad would always say, hey, if you're ever going to go into business for yourself, go into food, shelter, or clothing. And, I never knew how much that meant until I decided to go into business for myself. And I've been in shelter forever, right? Mm-hmm. I had a general contracting business, and I had grown a pretty good sized general contracting company in the suburbs of Chicago. And one morning I woke up and I was just burnt out. I couldn't do it anymore. And I decided to sell my company and take a year off. And during that time, I house hacked. My wife and I at the time, we house hacked. And this was long before house hacking was sexy or fun to do, right? Now mm-hmm. everybody does it. But mm-hmm. back then, it was not the thing to do. And we did two flats during that time. And I found that I met a real estate agent who was very successful. And one thing I had known was success always left clues. So I went to him and I said, Todd, would you, I'm thinking about going into the real estate business. And he said, I think you'll be very successful at it. He goes, all you have to do is apply some principles and stay focused and you'll do well. I said, well, would you teach me what to do or could I come and shadow you? And he said, no, what I'll do is I'll make you a cassette tape. Now, Prashant, I'm going to date myself a little bit because not only is a cassette tape hard to find today, but a thing to make a cassette tape on is hard to find today. So but he made me a cassette tape and I listened to that thing over and over and over again to understand what I needed to do to go out and build a real estate business. I went into real estate in 1990 and my first 8 months in the business, I sold 78 homes and was RE/MAX Rookie of the Year that year. I went on to build a team that we sold 125 houses a year and did that about 8 years consecutively.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so then as, you know, as time rolled along, 2005 started to come along and I realized that the market was starting to soften. Wasn't really sure what I was going to do, but I knew that I wouldn't be able to keep that same production up. Now, I'd always wanted to be in the apartment business. When I was in the construction business, I did a lot of work for a company who today is the largest REIT in the world. And I watched these guys. It was four high school teachers. They bought their first four-unit apartment building in Chicago. And from there, they grew to be, you know, the largest REIT in the world in every asset class across the block. And what I when I was in the apartment or in the construction business, so I did a lot of work for these guys on their swimming pools and in their apartments. And I understood the model, you know, that simple method of private equity where you raise money from private individuals, you marry it with a great real estate deal. And Prashant, as long as everything goes okay, everybody makes money. So 2005, I made a decision to go in the apartment business. Mm-hmm. And I started to syndicate apartment deals. I did my first deal and it was a small 11 unit apartment building. And how I raised the money on that was I put a little ad in the newspaper that said real estate investors want it. And my phone rang off the hook and I was able to raise about $200,000 on a $600,000 deal. And I thought, wow, this is going to be great. Mm-hmm. And over the next 18 months, I raised over the next 18 months, I raised $18 million.
Wow.
Let me back up. Over the next 30 months, I raised $18 million. I bought $60 million worth of real estate, and it was about just under 4,000 units in five different states.
Wow. In 2.5 years, you were able to raise $30 million. Mike, I would like to just ask, was the Reg D prevalent that time? Because I'm not from that time. I did not start doing real estate at that time. Did you have to write PPMs, 506B versus 506C? Anything like that was there for you? Or you could just place the ad on the newspaper for any deal that you may have?
You could not place an ad in the newspaper. You could not raise money like you can raise money today. Mm-hmm. What people do on social media today, what people do with crowdfunding today was absolutely not what we did then. Mm-hmm. You know, I put an ad in the paper. I didn't talk anything about raising money. And I only did it one time. I said, real estate investors want it. And when people called, because what I knew about it, and, you know, I didn't know a lot, but what I knew about it was that I had to have a relationship with somebody in order. So when people called, I would tell them, you know, hey, you know, we're syndicating an apartment deal and raising money. I'm looking for partners. And But that was the only time I did it. After beyond that, what I started to do was have seminars in my office. And every Tuesday and Thursday night for about 2 years, I put 20 new faces in a conference room in my office. Mm-hmm. And what I did was I taught the principles of real estate investing. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the seminar, I would say, hey, by the way, I have this deal that we're raising money on. And I would share that, show that. And, you know, it was kind of funny because at that time, people wanted to just write you a check right now. All the time. And wow. And I always would say, you know, we can't do that. You know, we have to let you walk away for 3 days and, you know, that cooling off period and not talk to people and, you know, have that relationship with them, mm-hmm. which was, you know, I tended to walk in a gray area sometimes in those relationships, but, mm-hmm. You know, we learned along the way.
Mm-hmm. So, okay. Oh, very nice. I mean, that's impressive. That, I mean, nowadays kind of raising money has sort of become so difficult in the sense that if you don't know, if you are new, or if you are trying to just raise money over social media, it's just not possible that easy. I mean, it's not that easy. It is easy that you can do it on social media, but social media is full of those things all the time. Right. They are I mean, I get like 15, 20 offering memorandums, in my inbox, like on a daily basis. You know, it's so difficult for me to even, look at them, let alone putting LOI against them. And then, you know, everybody, those who are in those deals, they are sending emails sending emails to everybody, you know. No, interesting. So, Mike, tell us, you know, when you did your first syndication or your subsequent syndications, how did you start them and what was there in your mind? I mean, I know the topic today is know your exit plan before you enter in a deal.
Right.
So, you know, educate our listeners today on what was your strategy, you know, What were you thinking, you know, in all these years, you know, when you entered those deals?
So exit plan wasn't something that I thought about from the beginning, right? Okay. When I mm-hmm. when I did my first syndication, I was so excited that I was going to buy this 11 unit deal, and mm-hmm. that not only were we going to be able to buy it, but that I had found people who were going to invest in it. And when I found two investors that were going to put up the money to do this deal, I was beside myself. I made some mistakes. I didn't do the due diligence that should have been done. I didn't look at early evaluation things like, crime rates and population growth and job growth. I took the seller's word on everything. And worse than that, I took the seller's word and the broker's word. Now, it was an 11-unit deal, right? It wasn't a big deal, but it was a disaster. Mm-hmm. I bought that deal. When we closed on it, I went, oh, my gosh, what'd we buy, right? Because the seller said, oh, you'll be able to raise the rents $50. Well, the rents were already $50 too high. Yeah. And you'll be able to move those tenants out, remodel, and put new tenants in. Well, we weren't able to do any of that. Was in a really bad part of town. Matter of fact, the police visited the property 28 times a month. Now, in February, they were there more than the days in the month, right? Wow. But through the regular time, they were there at least once a day on domestic disputes. Mm-hmm. So it was really a bad deal. But here's what I realized after buying that. And I called my broker and I said, look, I said, we did this wrong. We have to do this right. I have to develop a buying criteria. And that was my first step, I think, towards developing an exit plan. And that was, you know, what does that buying criteria look like? Well, how much did I want to pay per unit? What market did I want to be in? What class of product did I want it to be? What did I want it to look like aesthetically? The first deal I bought was a flat roof deal and I hated it. So after that, I went on and we bought pitched roofs, right? So it all came down to buying strategy and what we were going to buy. But along the way, I realized that it wasn't just going into the deal, it was coming out, and that we had to start to work on the exit plan as well. You know, I read a book years ago by Stephen Covey, which was Seven Habits of Highly Effective People.
Yeah.
And in that book, chapter two is start with the end in mind. And for whatever reason, that stuck with me forever, for a long time. So I look at it this way. I said, you know, I've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars over the years on coaching and training and books and tapes and some really great trainers in the marketplace. I've had some really great coaches myself. Here's what I found out, though, is everybody teaches you how to get in a deal. Everybody teaches you how to buy it, find it, get in it, and operate it. Nobody teaches you how to get out.
Yeah.
And what I realized is that we need to know how to get out of the deal. And you need to know and have that exit plan before you ever even get to the closing table when you're on your purchase side. So, and it starts early on with your evaluation. It starts with your projections. It starts with your CapEx plan, your operational plan, the things that you're going to do along the way to re-engineer that property and get it ready for to put back on the market.
So do you ever have like multiple exit plans? I mean, multiple exit strategies? I mean, you may plan for something, you know, plan A, but, you know, it really happens that plan A works.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's a great question. I just had this conversation with somebody this afternoon, so it's kind of funny that you're even bringing it up again. But yeah, I think you need to have multiple exit plans. And and here, you know, here's how I think that you need to look at it, right? When you evaluate a deal and you have, you know, you look at a 10-year projection on that deal, there's invariably a sweet spot somewhere along the way. And by that, I mean that somewhere between 5.5 years and 8 years, you're going to have your most profitable point, right? So why not do something at that point? Why not recapitalize the property? Why not restructure the deal, pull capital out and re-engineer the property to run it again for a number of years? So you need to, you need to look at different scenarios. Here, what happens along the way if you bring a partner in a deal? How do you re-engineer it? You know, there's an exit there at that point when you would bring a new partner in. Say you're in a deal with private equity investors. And all of a sudden an institutional partner wants to come in a deal. And you structure a deal like that. You have to have an exit plan around that. Then you have to have an exit plan a number of years down the road again. So yeah, I think it's something you always have to keep in mind. You know, here, there's a saying in real estate that says we make money when we go in the deal, which is true. It's how we buy it and it's based on the terms that we buy it at, right?
Right.
But we don't realize that gain till we exit.
Yes.
So, and here's the interesting thing, Prashant, is that exiting doesn't always mean that you are selling out of the deal or giving up control.
Yeah.
You could recapitalize, bring a partner in. There's a number of things you can do along the way.
Got it. And yeah, I mean, in my mind, you know, basically those who get into real estate, they, for them, getting into real estate is buying a single family home or buying a multifamily where, you know, they have partnership. So they have the pride of ownership. And for them, exit is, okay, I'm done. I have sold this property. But to your point, elaborate on that a little bit more, Mike, if you would. What do you exactly mean by other ways of exiting, if it is okay with you?
Yeah, so, you know, it's like what I said a minute ago about, you know, we did a deal one time where we were trying to bring a institutional partner in to buy the deal originally. And the institutional partner just, I couldn't get him over the goal line. I think it was a level of trust at that point, a point where he just, you know, he didn't believe in us as an operator yet. So I had this deal under contract. We had to get it closed. We had to get it closed before our, you know, our earnest money had already gone hard. And so I brought private investors to the table and we were able to close the deal with private investors. Well, about 8 months later, the institutional buyer decided that he wanted in on the deal. So, because he had watched, and I kept sending him reports of what we were doing on the property. We were doing renovations, we were re-tenanting the property, we restructured it, we raised rents, we got a lot of repairs done, we did some curb appeal, and it was operating at a higher level. The NOI had increased, the value had increased. So now we bring this new partner in. It was an institution, and the life insurance company came in. We took out the private investors in the deal. They made a little bit of extra money. And, you know, we put this institutional buyer in and continued to run the deal. We ran the deal out again. So I think that there's things you need to look at and see how they're going to work for you. Hey, I talked about, you know, there being a sweet spot along the way. What if at year seven, if you ran a performa for 10 years and at year six or year seven, you hit your most profitable point in the deal?
Yeah.
Why not have a plan around the fact that, hey, I'm going to go in, I'm going to do a, cash out refi. I'm going to pull that out. I'm going to pull that capital out of the property. And I'm going to do a principal buy down on my equity investors. Now, as the sponsor, you own more of the asset. You've done a principal buy down. Your investors have less, have less principal in the deal. You can structure that a number of different ways. You can leave them in at the same equity piece. You can reduce their equity. You have a number of different choices. So what's interesting about understanding your exit plan is that you understand the choices that you have. And, you know, it's all about the choices we make, isn't it, Prashant?
Yeah, that is actually correct. I mean, whenever we are doing something, we always have multiple choices.
Sometimes they're good and sometimes they're bad.
That is correct. And there are some bad choices also. Well, Mike, very interesting. We are having good conversation and I'm learning a lot. But Mike, what you were talking earlier in terms of the exit plan, what you said about multifamily, I mean, that is something that comes with experience, right? I mean, this is not something that any new person would be able to kind of put together, you know, in the middle of the project. In the middle of the project, you know, try to take out the equity and bring in institutional buyers. It's kind of relating to the creative financing for single family homes. Is that a correct assumption that I would say?
Are you asking, is it like refinancing a single family home?
Yeah, so you remember we have creative ways of doing our single family business also, right? Where we do the refinancing, or we, you know, lease to rent to lease kind of things.
Right.
There are a bunch of things that we do, creative ways of owning the real estate in single family world. Similarly, in multifamily, the things that you were just talking, are they similar? Or they are different?
Well, I think they're similar, okay, but they're different, right? Because it's not the same process. The commercial process is different than the residential process. Mm-hmm. However, the principles are the same, right? And it's, you know, I'm huge about mastering the fundamentals. You know, it's like when I would teach my kids' Little League team to continually field the grounders, right? And they would always get so frustrated because, you know, oh, coach, can't we do pop-ups or can't we have batting practice? And no, because you've got to learn the fundamentals first. And I believe that when you learn the fundamentals along in the multifamily business, in the residential business, that you can grow do the same techniques in the commercial space.
So basically, to get into commercial space. I mean, not everybody can get into commercial space so easily, right? I really want to understand what does it take for somebody to get into commercial space and make their way through.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't think that, I don't believe that you can go out and buy a 200 unit apartment complex the first deal that you're going to do. Mm-hmm. I never thought when I went into the apartment business, I never had a vision that I would be buying 200 unit apartment complexes, but I was buying 300 and 400 unit apartment complexes. The first deal I did was 11 units. And then there's that transition. Remember I said I had to design a buying strategy after I bought that first deal. Then I started to look at other deals in other markets. And I bought an 11 unit, then I bought a 64 unit and an 87 unit. And then when it was 100 and I think the next one was like 130 and then 180. So it was a transition, right? I think that every time you do a deal, whether it's I'm coming out of the residential market and on the residential side to going into the commercial side, every time you do a deal, you learn something different. And you need to pay attention to the things around you that happen, right? Because there's things that'll come up. There's red flags that you're going to see along the way. Don't ignore them. You know, I talked about our business and how fast we grew. Well, you know, to buy in 2007, I closed 17 deals. It was about 2,700 units. And I would never advise anybody to do that because it creates an instability in your business. For us, it was like, because of lack of experience, right? Mm-hmm. We were very unstable. It was like balancing on two legs of a four-legged chair. And based on those transactions, I put the company in a position where it wasn't much longer before we were going to be in a really tough situation and falter. So, you know, there were a number of mistakes that I made along the way in the transition because of lack of experience. Mm-hmm. And I think experience happens as a result of doing deals, getting your knowledge, looking at things, thinking things through from the beginning to the end, understanding what the exit needs to be, understanding what the process along the way is, mm-hmm. and making the mistakes. Because you're going to make mistakes, but how do you get up from those mistakes that we make?
So how much do you think is your mindset? What is the role of mindset in this journey? I know our mindset is we want to go for bigger and better and bigger and better and bigger and better all the time. But at the same time, you don't want to burn yourself also. Right. So tell me a little bit about the kind of mistakes that you mentioned just about one of them right now. What did you learn and what did you do to your mindset, or what was the reason those things happened, and what is the role of the mindset in general in your growth?
I like that question. I think that that's a great question about mindset. I believe in anything that we do, our mindset is really important. We have to stay committed to the process, and we have to believe in ourselves and believe in the process, right? However, there are things that happen along the way that mindset you can't control. Okay, 2008, the world hit the worst economic crisis ever, and I don't care how good somebody's mindset was, you aren't going to control that when that happens, right? That's going to happen. And as a result of a number of business mistakes that I made along the way, when we got to 2008, we had some problems moving forward from that point on as a result of where the world went.
Yeah. So So basic thing is, yes, you have a great mindset, but you are still making some mistakes, you know, which are not your not something wrong that you have done. How to avoid those mistakes, you know?
Yeah. Well, some of it was what I had done. Okay. So along the way, a couple, some of the mistakes that I made was I was over leveraged. Mm-hmm. So I bought $60 million worth of real estate at about 15% down. I had 85% loan to value. Mm-hmm. That's a disaster waiting to happen. When you look at it today, I would never advise anybody, just because the bank is going to throw money at you or the lenders are going to throw money at you, to go into deals at that level of loan to value. Mm-hmm. You want to make sure that you're 65 to 70% loan to value on everything across the board. Mm-hmm. The other thing was I overpaid for properties. The market, so 2008 happened. There was a crush in the residential side. I didn't really believe that it was going to affect the commercial side, mm-hmm. much less did I believe that it was going to affect the multifamily side, but it did. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, I kept buying properties as property values were going up. There was a this false inflation of property values, and we paid it. Mm-hmm. And so I overbought for properties. I was over leveraged. I bought too many properties too fast. Mm-hmm. I was very unstable. And then I had, I built a pretty substantial company, had a lot of people around the country working for me, some who were very good at what they did and some who weren't. And as a result of some people's inability to handle the pressure and handle what was going on, there were some more mistakes made. That instability rolled over into management. It rolled over into operations and not being able to run deals properly, right? Not being able to structure you can write a really good business plan, but if you don't have somebody executing that business plan who can execute it, then it's not worth the paper it's written on. And I can tell you that we wrote some really good business plans, and but the execution on them was not very good. So I had a tendency, I did not look at the red flags. There were a number of red flags of things going on in my business that I didn't pay attention to. Mm-hmm. You know, I was under the opinion that if I could close another deal and bring some more capital in, that mm-hmm. that would keep things running and keep things afloat. Mm-hmm. So what ultimately wound up happening was that in 2008, it's funny because, Lehman Brothers went out of business, Bear Stearns, AIG, some companies that have been around for years and years. You had lenders like Countrywide and Taylor Bean and Whitaker, and some major lenders in the country just get destroyed because of what happened in the markets, bad paper, bad debt, foreclosures. There were a number of things that happened. I thought we could weather the storm. Well, we couldn't. And because of the instability, because of the over leverage, we started to see deals go to foreclosure. So by mid 2009, we started to have properties that went from mid to low 90s in occupancy drop into the low 70s in occupancy. All of a sudden, we started to lose our NOI. Property values went down, and we couldn't sustain the storm. Couldn't pay the bills, couldn't pay investors. Ultimately, what wound up happening was I got charged with wire fraud and mail fraud charges, mm-hmm. and ultimately pled guilty and was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison as a result of it.
Sorry.
So, sometimes the best laid plans don't go really well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so... there were those mistakes made along the way. I took responsibility for the mistakes. Here's what happened, and here's why it happened. I moved money between companies. So I had some very profitable companies, some companies that were throwing off good revenue, and then I had a number of companies that weren't. that were running very poorly. So I would take money from good profitable companies, move them into the other companies. As a result of that, I didn't disclose it to my investors. And because of non-disclosure to my investors is the reason that I wound up getting charged with wire fraud and mail fraud charges. You know, it's funny, our lifestyles never changed. I didn't buy a bigger house or fly private, didn't have a boat, you know, no summer homes. But because we misappropriated funds and we didn't tell the investors, you know, Prashant, if I were to come to you and said, hey, listen, we have a problem with this deal. We need to move some money over here. We'll put it back as soon as the market comes back. You probably would have said, okay. But here was my belief in it too. My belief was, okay, so you're back to the mindset question. And my belief was that I had never seen a recession last longer than 17 or 18 months. I'd never seen a correction in the marketplace be greater than 10%. Mm-hmm. Here we've got a real estate correction and a market overall correction of 40%. Here we have a correction that lasted 7 or 8 years, and there's still people today who haven't recovered from it. So as a result of everything that happened around me, I made some mistakes, tried to protect all my investors because I, you know, for me, I'm the kind of guy that hates to fail. And I don't want to come to you and say I made a mistake or fail. I'm the oldest born, right? I'm the hero. So I want to make sure that I do good by you. So I couldn't come to you and tell you that something was wrong. Plus I wrote my documents wrong. And in my documents, I wrote that we would never come and ask for a cash call. Another mistake. So I made, you know, I have a list of probably 20 business mistakes that I made that, you know, when I go to syndicate deals next time and raise money again, that, you know, I'll be really clear on those mistakes of how not to make them. So I did go to prison in 2013. I served about 7.5 years. In a federal prison camp. I came home in March of last year, and I've been home a little more than a year now. While I was gone, I wrote 2 books. The first book, of course, I wrote was Exit Plan, Your Complete Guide to Multifamily Investing and Why You Need an Exit Plan Before You Buy. I wrote a property management book, which I hope to have out later this year. I taught real estate investing and property management in prison for 5 years. I wrote an ethics course that I taught for 5 years. I went to college. I got a bachelor's degree in theology. I taught Bible study for 5 years. I was on an outreach program, went into the community, told my story about 40 times to the local businesses, some major corporations in the area, and to the colleges in the area. We were on this rotation with different classes. During that time, I met a professor from the University of Minnesota who was, I went to his class probably 4 or 5 times while I was on this outreach program. We developed a relationship and we co-authored a white paper that just got published in the Business Journal of Ethics on a case study, on my case study. Today it gets taught at the college level for forensic accounting classes and sales and marketing classes. So I learned a lot while I was gone. I learned a lot along the way. And today I'm home and I'm in the training and coaching business. And, you know, I hope that when I deliver my message, that it brings a message of, you know, we can have this great success. We can lose everything. But now what are you going to do? You can stub your toe, you know, but are you going to let it keep you down? So I chose to bounce back, right? And I have a whole, you know, there's a story behind that, you know, when I was gone, I was probably about 6 weeks into my prison stay. I was in a really bad place. I went to prison, thought I was losing everything. And then I thought that could be the worst thing that happened in my life. And then my wife told me that she was going to leave me. And when that happened, that just ruined me. And the people around me, and the interesting thing about prison is that people kind of help each other. They come to your rescue. You know, even the guys that you think are the worst of the worst, they will come and they will lift you up and they will help you when you're down and in need. But this guy came up to me in the gym. I was probably gone for just under a couple of months. And he said, look, don't let these people beat you. All they want to do is take from you everything that you've ever done. He said, what they can't take from you is they can't take your mindset. They can't take who you are at the core. They can't take your knowledge and your experience. He goes, come to this gym every day, rebuild your life, feel better about yourself, and everything will start coming back. And I did. I started to go work out every day. You know, one thing led to another. I wound up in college. I wound up writing books. I wound up teaching. And, you know, today I'm here to give back and to help other people not make some of the same choices that I made and show that there is redemption on the other side. So even when you struggle and fall and fail, get back up because you can succeed.
Just a few more things from my side also. Those who are interested in learning the benefits of passive investing, I have 7-day email course on my website, myrealtygains.com. I have a, you know, it's a free video course that I have created for a bunch of my friends. And anybody wants to join the Passionate Passive Investor Club, a little bit more deeper knowledge than 7-day email course. All free stuff, nothing, you know, nothing, no charge, no obligation of any sort. All right, guys, thank you so much. We are on the top of the hour. Appreciate you spending time with us.